Our scripture for today is taken from the book of Exodus, chapter 17. Beginning with verse 1, the word of the Lord is as follows. At the Lord's command, the whole community of Israel left the wilderness of Zin and moved from place to place. Eventually, they camped at Rephidim, but there was no water there for the people to drink. So once more, the people complained against Moses. "Give us water to drink," they demanded. "Quiet," Moses replied. "Why are you complaining against me? And why are you testing the Lord?" But tormented by thirst, they continued to argue with Moses. "Why did you bring us out of Egypt? Are you trying to kill us, our children, and our livestock with thirst?" Then Moses cried out to the Lord, "What should I do with these people? They are ready to stone me." The Lord said to Moses, "Walk out in front of the people. Take your staff, the one you used when you struck the water of the Nile, and call some of the elders of Israel to join you. I will stand before you on the rock at Mount Sinai. Strike the rock, and water will come gushing out. Then the people will be able to drink." So Moses struck the rock as he was told, and water gushed out as the elders looked on. Moses named the place Massah, which means test, and Meribah, which means arguing, because the people of Israel argued with Moses and tested the Lord by saying, "Is the Lord here with us or not?" Thus far, the word of the Lord. You may be seated. I want you to check out this clip.
"Darling. Winston, darling. There's someone to see you. You have a visitor.
Right now you have the full weight of the world on your shoulders.
I know.
But these inner battles have actually trained you for this very moment. You are strong because you are imperfect. You are wise because you have doubts. Now, shall I let him in?"
Who?
"The king."
Which king? Our king?
Well, if it isn't him, it's a marvellous impersonation.
"Mr. Churchill, I hope you can forgive the late hour, but your wife thought tonight would be a good time. Shall we sit?"
Yes, please. Something to drink.
Yes. "I received a visit
from
Viscount Halifax. It appears that the prospect of peace deal has increased dramatically."
The war cabinet are drafting a letter to Mussolini, asking him to broker talks with Hitler.
"Then Halifax was correct."
I should like to know your mind.
"It would be helpful to know yours first."
I should like to know it myself. "Nations which go down fighting rise again, and those that surrender tamely are finished."
"Belgium?"
"Collapse."
"Norway?"
"Holland." France, any other.
And the mode of parliament?
Fear, panic.
And you? Are you not afraid?
I am most terribly. Support in the war cabinet for the campaign of resistance has collapsed. Later today, I will address the House accordingly.
You have my support.
Your Majesty.
You have my support. I confess, I had some reservations about you at first, but while some in this country dreaded your appointment, none dreaded it like Adolf Hitler. Whomever can strike fear into that brute heart is worthy of all of our trust. We shall work together. You shall have my support at any hour. Beat the buggers.
That is a scene from the movie The Darkest Hour, which earned several Academy Awards. Gary Oldman, himself playing Winston Churchill, was awarded Best Actor during this year. The film is a depiction of the early years of Winston Churchill's first term as Prime Minister of England. And with Hitler and Nazi Germany overtaking much of Europe, the one thing that stood between them and the total domination of Europe itself was England. Many within England at that time were of the mindset that Nazi victory was a foregone conclusion, and that the best step was to try to negotiate a peaceful settlement with Hitler and hope for the best. Winston Churchill, however, was of a different mind. He recognized Hitler and the Third Reich for the menace that they truly were, and that negotiating with Hitler would be tantamount to the appeasement and capitulation of his predecessor, Neville Chamberlain. The movie depicts the battle within Churchill and within his cabinet. Many of the people whom Churchill appointed, fearful of Hitler, opposed him and had even decided to propose a vote of no confidence, which would result in his ouster. Slowly, Churchill begins to doubt himself and considers entering into a negotiated settlement. The night before he is to address Parliament, he sits alone in his basement. And this scene depicts on that night as he is considering giving in to Nazi Germany. King George VI visits Churchill and lets him know he supports him. He will be on his side. And the word from the king was what he needed to regain his resolve and to take his stand. Had Churchill not regained his resolve, had he not retaken his stand, the history of Europe and even the world might be drastically different today. I've seen this movie for several times, and always I am touched by the criticality and the tenuousness of leadership. The sheer force of Churchill's intellect, certainty, and personality was all that stood between England's freedom and Hitler's domination. Let's just take a world history refresher. At that time, America stood on the sidelines with a posture of non-engagement. Isolationist sentiments America First ideology ruled the land. It was our foreign policy. It would not be until Japan dropped bombs on Pearl Harbor that we would shed our isolationism and enter into the struggle for the liberation of Europe, the defeat of Nazi Germany, fascist Italy, and imperialist Japan. And prior to that time, the one person whose sheer force of will as a leader held things at bay until we got off the sidelines was Winston Churchill. Leadership is critical. And the criticality of leadership is not just what the leader produces, it's also what the leader prevents. It's not just what a leader makes happen, it's also what a leader keeps from happening. It's not just what you put on the table, but it's also what you nip in the bud, what you cut off at the corner, what you keep from coming up to the surface. As much as we tout what leaders make happen, if you just knew what leaders kept from happening, if it's one thing to know of terror attacks that we stop, but if you just knew the stuff that never even comes to the forefront, that leaders cut off at the pass, it would blow your mind. Leadership is critical, not just for what it makes happen, but for what it stops from happening. And yet leadership is extremely tenuous because there is tremendous isolation in being a leader. Real leadership, true leadership, is isolating. Why? Because the leader sees things before anyone else sees them. A leader sees further than anyone else. A leader sees deeper than anyone else. A leader sees clearer than anyone else. A leader has a sense of urgency that no one else possesses. Why? Because no one else sees the things that a leader sees. And because no one sees what a leader sees as a leader sees it, the leader often falls subject to the weight of other people's thoughts, the weight of other people's opinions, and the frustrations and the doubts of other people can easily penetrate the heart and mind of the leader. And if the leader isn't careful, people's doubts and frustrations can become the leader's doubts and frustrations. Winston Churchill, in that scene, sat literally alone in his basement, considering capitulating to Hitler. The darkest hour, as depicted in this movie, was not the hour of Germany dropping bombs on London. The darkest hour was not the time when at Dunkirk thousands of soldiers were slain by German artillery. The darkest hour was the hour when Churchill sat in his basement alone, considering giving in to Adolf Hitler. Friends, a leader's darkest hour, and if you were waiting for the title of the sermon, that's what it is, a leader's darkest hour. A leader's darkest hour is when he or she finds himself or herself contemplating abrogating or giving up the role of leadership that gives way to the enemy. It's not leading and losing a fight in the battle. It's giving up leadership such that you never get to the battle. It's a parent giving up their position as being the parent and becoming a child. It's a leader giving in, relinquishing what he or she believes to be right, due to the pressure of the weight of doubts and fears of other people. It's the time where everyone else's lack of clarity and courage surrounds the leader to the point that the leader questions his or her clarity and loses his or her courage. It's when the leading scorer stops shooting because he or she has missed some baskets. If you look at Michael Jordan and you check out his record, he missed more than he made. We just remember the ones that he made. If he had stopped shooting because he missed some, he would not be the GOAT as we think that he is. If you look at Steph Curry and you examine how many shots Steph has missed, it will shock you that he's missed almost twice as many as he's made. But we don't think about that. We just think of the ones that he made. What a tragedy it would be if he doubted himself or allowed the doubts of others to cause him to stop shooting. A leader's darkest hour is when the leader starts questioning his or her clarity and begins to lose his or her courage. And such is the case for Moses in our text. Israel is fresh in its journey towards the land of promise. They have left the wilderness of Zin, and eventually they have moved to the place of Rephidim. Now, if you listened or if you were reading, it says, at the Lord's command. They are being led by God by a pillar of cloud by day and fire by night. And as they are following the Lord's command, being led by a pillar of cloud by day and fire by night, they get to a place called Rephidim, where there is no water. Look at your neighbor and say, God led them where there was no water. And when they arrive there, they're feeling some kind of way. Now in chapter 15, that's two chapters before, after having been delivered from Pharaoh through the Red Sea, they come to a place called Marah, where the water was bitter. And there the people complained against Moses. And in chapter 16, they complained about the food not tasting like the food of Egypt, and saying it would be better for them to go back to bondage in Egypt. And now here they are in chapter 17, being led by God where there is no water, and they do the same thing. They accuse Moses of trying to kill them in the wilderness. And with the people questioning whether or not the Lord is with them, Moses is at a point of exasperation. Now, there are times when you following God's desire for your life will cause those around you to wonder about God's position, God's presence, and God's purpose concerning you. And sometimes God's path is not the way that you or they would expect. It can be longer than expected. It can be more complex than expected. It can be more problematic than expected. And like Moses, you can find yourself at a point of exasperation. And yet it is here that Moses shows us what to do. When you find yourself clouded by the thoughts and fears of others, you've got to rush to get a word from the king. Moses shows us that in times where there is lack of clarity or failure of courage, and you are holding a point of leadership, not just producing but preventing, you've got to rush to get a word from the king. Rather than being in your basement waiting on the king to come to you, you've got to run to where the king is. Do you see it in the text? Rather than respond to the words of people, Moses rushes to get a word from the Lord. Because Moses understands that their problem and their argument is really not with him, it's with God. They are being led by God. They are being led by a pillar of cloud by day and fire by night, and the cloud stops in Rephidim. The cloud stops where there is no water, and this is God leading them. And therefore, Moses says, I've got to go directly to God. When you're following God puts you in a place where people will question your following God and his presence with you, it's easy for you to want to respond to them directly. It's natural to want to provide a rational defense for your following God. However, God's directions to you aren't always rational to everybody else. They aren't always apparent or obvious to everyone else. They aren't always comfortable for everyone else. They aren't always desirable to everyone else. And therefore, in those cases, you need to rush to God rather than react to people. As Winston Churchill sat in the basement, the king came to him and gave him this word: I support you. I'm with you. I back you. I'm on your side. I know what the war cabinet says, and I know how Parliament feels, but the king says, I'm by your side. And friends, there are times when you need a word from the king. And the good news is that the king will visit you. The king will give you a word. Earlier on the backside of the mountain, the king, from amidst of a bush that was burning, yet not consumed, gave Moses the word, certainly I will be with you. And now the king tells Moses, I will stand before you. I tell your neighbor, you got to pay attention to words. The God who was with Moses is also the God who will stand before Moses. The God who accompanies Moses will be the God who shows himself to be seen by Moses. He stands before Moses to handle what's coming towards Moses before it arrives at Moses. He is the God who detoxifies it before it ever gets near him. He is the God who stands before Moses as the primary point of consideration that Moses should have. As Moses hears what people say, his eyes are staying on God. And as his eyes stay on God, God will guide him as he should go. Isn't it good to know that the God who promises to be with you is the God who promises to stand before you? He stands before you to be seen by you. He stands before you to be the most dominant consideration that you will have. He stands before you to be the primary point of focus. He stands before you to be the lens through which you see everything else. He stands before you to be the filter through which everything else must come. In other words, God says, if it gets to you, it's got to come through him, which means if it comes through him and he lets it get to you, it will never do what it really wants to do. That's why you can know that no weapon that's formed against you shall be able to prosper, because if it hits you, it's got to go through him first. The king says, I'll stand before you. He'll give you a word. He gave Joshua that very same word. No one will be able to stand against you as long as you live, for I will be with you as I was with Moses. I will not fail you. I will not abandon you. In the city of Corinth, God gave Paul the very same words. Keep it up and don't let anyone intimidate you or silence you. No matter what happens, I am with you and no one is going to be able to hurt you. The king will give you a word. And I wonder, is there anybody who can testify that you were visited by the king and the king gave you a word? The king told you that no weapon that's formed against you shall be able to prosper. The king told you, greater is he that is in you than he that is in the world. The king told you that nay, in all these things, you are more than conquerors through Christ who loved you. The king told you, weeping may endure for a night, but joy comes in the morning. The king told you, I will supply all your needs according to my riches and glory. The king gave you a word. When the king gives you a word, there's one thing for you to do: follow the king's instructions. God gives Moses particular instructions. Look at what he says. He says, walk out in front of the people, take your staff, the one that you used when you struck the water of the Nile, and call some of the elders of Israel to join you. Then God says, I will stand before you, before on the rock at Mount Sinai, strike the rock, and water will come gushing out. God tells Moses, take the staff, the one that he used at the Nile, the one that he also used at the Red Sea, and strike the rock, and water will come from it. Now, that may not seem so strange to you, but if you've ever taken a basic science class, what God is saying defies logic. God is saying liquid will come out of a solid. He is not saying strike ice and water will come out. He is saying strike a rock and water will come out. That's a strange point of instruction. I could understand God saying remove a rock that's blocking water. Or God simply saying, I will cause water to come around a rock. But for God to say, strike a rock and water will come from it, that's something altogether different. I guess what I'm trying to impress upon us is that not all of God's instructions are going to make sense to us. However, Moses just does what God tells him to do. And he does it because he has a history with God making strange instructions. On the backside of the mountain, from the midst of the bush that was burning, yet not consumed, God told Moses, take that staff, that rod in your hand, and throw it to the ground. And Moses does it, and it turns into a serpent. And Moses jumps back. And then God tells him, now, I want you to put your hand on what you're afraid of. And Moses takes it and it turns back into the staff. And then God tells him, now, I want you later to take that staff and have Aaron dip it in the Nile, and the Nile River turns to blood. God says, I want you to raise that above the earth, and then the plagues of flies and gnats and murrain and boils come by just by lifting up that staff. Hail comes down from heaven and turns into fire once it hits the ground. When their backs are against the wall at the Red Sea, and God tells them, stand still and see the salvation of the Lord, which the Lord will fight for you. The Lord will fight your battles and you'll hold your peace. The Egyptians that you see now, you will never see again. God says, take that same staff and raise it over the Red Sea. And Moses does that, and the waters part, and they cross over on dry ground. God, and because Moses has had this type of history with God giving him some strange instructions, now Moses says, the same God is still giving me strange instructions, but they no longer seem as strange to me anymore. I guess what I'm trying to say is all Moses needed to know is that with a strange instruction, God was going to meet the need. God was going to provide for the current situation. And it's in following the instructions of the king that you get what the king has for you. In that movie, King George not only told Churchill of his support, but King George gives Churchill a word of instruction. With Parliament, with the war cabinet being against him, ready to vote a vote of no confidence, the king says, go out to the people. Listen to what the people have to say. Engage the people in conversation. And as Churchill is portrayed riding on the subway, he engages the people in conversation. And the people are used to give him the buoyancy and the confidence that is needed. And when he gets off the subway and goes into Parliament and stands before Parliament, when they are ready with their handkerchiefs in their hands to do a vote of no confidence, Churchill gives one of the greatest speeches of his career and turns the whole nation in defiance of Hitler. And history, my God, is what it is because he followed the king's instructions. I just want somebody to know it's when you follow the king's instructions that the king can give you exactly what you need. It's as you follow the king's instructions that the king is able to prove himself to you. you. And here is the tension. The tension is that the king's instructions are according to the king's thoughts and the king's ways. And as his thoughts and as his ways are higher than ours, they often seem strange to us. And yet God's strange ways are the paths to God's supernatural results. If you want the supernatural results, you got to follow the strange ways. I'm on somebody's street right now. Because you want the supernatural results of God, but you want them to come by God giving you normal instructions. Yeah. You want his instructions to be natural to you, comfortable to you, reasonable to you, logical to you. In short, you want God's actions on your terms. Yeah, tell your neighbor, he's talking to me right now. And the problem is, God never lowers his instructions. I wish God would bring stuff down to where I am. But God never lowers his instructions. He never reduces his standard. He never eliminates the space between him and I when God is trying to tell me to do something that he has hooked supernatural results to. Because if he lowers it to my level, it'll get what I can produce. Yeah. But God says, if you want my results, you got to meet my requirements. And sometimes God's requirements are as strange as God telling you to strike a rock and expect water to come out of it. And yet it is in following God's instructions that the water flows. It's in bringing the tithe and the offering to God's house and discovering God opening the windows of heaven and pouring you out a blessing that you don't have room enough to receive. It's in doing good to your enemies and letting God pour coals of fire upon their heads. It's in seeking first the kingdom of God and his righteousness and then having God add all these other things unto you. It's in you humbling yourself under the mighty hand of God, and God in due season exalting you to a place where nobody can put you and nobody can take you down. Moses' history of following God's strange instructions before makes it easier for him to follow God's strange instructions now. The strange instructions that God gave him in Egypt make it easier for him to follow God's strange instructions now that they're on their way to the promised land. Past obedience makes present obedience easier. When you've heard God issue a strange directive and you've obeyed God and you've seen God do the supernatural in response to your obedience, my God, hearing and obeying God now is not as difficult. Why? Because your previous obedience has developed some muscle for you. It has developed some muscle memory in your spirit. You've seen God produce some unusual results from his unusual directions, and therefore you are better equipped for it now. I just connected a dot for somebody's life. The strange instructions of God in a prior place, in a prior stage of your life, God said, I just use so that now it makes more sense to you when I start talking the way that I talk. Because you heard it in your time of bondage and you saw me work your liberation. Now that you're on your way to promise and possession, when I tell you to do something strange, it no longer phases you because you've seen me do it. You understand that your location may have changed, your challenge may be different, but I am the same God, and the same God who issued the strange instruction before is the same God who is issuing the strange instruction now. And the good news is, I'm the same God who produced the miraculous. I'm the same God who produced the supernatural. I'm the same God who produced the incredible. I'm the same God who produced the inexplicable. And therefore, you've made up in your mind, it may be strange, but I got a history with a God who does strange things with strange instructions, and I believe him to be just as able now, just as powerful now, just as mighty now, just as miraculous now, just just as incredible now. What's in your history that God said, and you thought it strange, and you followed him, and you saw him do something you never expected capable of being done? Well, if you have that in your history, then now that you're at another place in your life and God is telling you something strange again, you should have no problem following this strange instruction, because it's the same God who's speaking to you, and the same God has the same power to produce the same results. God tells Moses, I will stand before you. And with Moses taking his place and following God's instructions, God would bring the water from the rock. It's not Moses to produce the water. It's God to produce the water. All Moses has to do is strike the rock, and God says, I'll make the water flow. And it's Moses' obedience, but it's God's work. It's Moses doing his part so that God can perform his. God says, I'm gonna handle my situation. I'm gonna make things happen. While there's something for Moses to do, there's something that only I can do. I made the rock. I know all of the attributes of the rock. And I know how I can bring water from the rock. You haven't designed it. You haven't made it. You haven't fashioned it. You don't know all of its properties. But I am the God who knows how to bring water from something that you think is incapable of producing water. And as Moses does his part, God made the water flow. God proved himself, which means don't just rush to the king to get a word, and don't just follow his instructions, but hang around and watch the king prove himself. Watch him do what only he can do. Watch him make the water flow from the rock. As you follow what God tells you to do, understand that the rest belongs to God, that there are some things for God to answer, some things for God to make happen, some things for God to turn around, some things are for God to open up. They're not for you to do. They're not even for you to talk about doing. It's just for you to do what God tells you to do, and know that the rest is up to God. And when you've done what God has told you to do, and you know that the rest is on God, you can be assured that God is going to do exactly what he said. He will do what only he can do. He'll bring water from the rock. He will clear the path. He'll provide the need. He'll shut the lion's mouth. He'll work it out. He will see you through. Follow the king and watch the king prove himself. He proved himself at Massa, and he proved himself at Meribah. He proved himself at the Jordan River, and he proved himself at the walls of Jericho, in the valley of Elah, when everybody else was afraid of Goliath. He proved himself on behalf of David. He proved himself in the furnace for the boys, and he proved himself in the lion's den for Daniel. In the darkest of hours, God is able to prove himself. And all God wants you to do is follow him and let him work. That's what he did for his son. It was a dark hour for him in the Garden of Gethsemane, when he prays so hard till sweat pours like drops of blood. And he says, Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me. But nevertheless, not my will, but thy will be done. And something happens. Something happens when he goes down on the third time. My God, the king visits him, and the king lets him know, I am with you. I will glorify my name, and my will be done, and you will not be disappointed. And so Jesus rises up, and he wakes the disciples out of their sleep, and he says, rise up. The betrayer is coming, but I've had a word from the king, and the king has let me know everything's going to be all right. And so he faces Judas, and he faces the mob, and he faces the Sanhedrin. He's ready for Pilate. He's ready for Herod. He's ready for the beating of the soldiers. He's ready for the crown of thorns on his head. He's ready for the weight of the cross cross on his shoulder. He's ready to be led along the Via Dolorosa. He's ready to be laid down and his hands nailed and his feet riveted to a rugged cross. He's ready to be raised up from the ground because he knows that the Father is with him and he has the Father's support. And when it got dark on the hill called Calvary and his mind was torn and his spirit was troubled, and he said, "My God, why hast thou forsaken me?" I'm feeling a sort of way right now. This weight is heavy. The sin is bad. The pain is intense. The loneliness is felt. Why have you left me to deal with what I'm dealing with? And the Father begins to minister to him by way of the word. He said, "If you quote my word, I'll quote it back to you." He quoted Psalm 22 when he said, my God, why hast thou forsaken me?" And I believe the Father said, "Okay, I'll do you one better. Can I flip the page and go to Psalm 23? The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside still waters. He restores my soul. He leads me in the path of righteousness for his name's sake. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I'll fear no evil, for thou art with me. Thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me. Thou preparest a table before me in the presence of mine enemies. You anoint my head with oil, and my cup runs over. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I'll dwell in the house of the Lord forever." The Father said, "I ain't gone anywhere. I'm a proof I'm with you. At Calvary, in your pain, I'm a proof myself with blood coming down, with pain being felt, with darkness all around you. I'm a prove myself. I'm a show myself strong and mighty at Calvary, on the cross." So with a thief saying, "Lord, when you come into your kingdom, remember me. I'm proving myself." When a soldier who's watched you be beaten, who's watched you be nailed, who's watched you be lifted, who's watching you die, when that soldier says, "Surely this must be the Son of God. I'm proving myself." When I give you power after the darkness to say, "Father, into thy hands I commend my spirit. I'm proving myself." When I let you give up the ghost and they put you in a grave and they say you can't come out, I'll prove myself in the grave. I'll let you descend into hell. Preach to the spirits that are held captive. Take the keys of death, hell, and the grave. And then early Sunday morning, I'll raise you with all power in your hand. I'll prove myself. Thank you, Jesus, that God is able to prove himself in crucifixion, in your pain, in your weariness, in your hurt, in your difficulty, yes, even in your death. But the God who lets you die is the God who's able to raise you up again. I just rang somebody's bell, because God didn't just prove himself after you went down. He proved himself when you went down. He showed you, "I'm able to keep you even if you fall. I'm able to raise you back up again." Slap five with your neighbor and say, "Neighbor, I've seen him in difficulty. I've seen him in trial. I've seen him in distress. I've seen him in pain. I've seen him in my tears. I've seen him in my defeat. I've seen him when I went down. But he was able to bring me back up. Even the youth shall faint and be weary, and the young men shall utterly fall. But they that wait upon the Lord shall renew their strength." Step five with your neighbor and tell your neighbor,
I mounted up with wings like an eagle. I've run and not get weary. I've walked and I have not fainted. I've seen him prove himself. He's been with me and before me, with me to assure me, before me to guide me, with me to accompany me, before me to direct me, with me in the present, before me in my future. High five your neighbor and say, neighbor, he's before you and with you. He's with you and ahead of you. Yeah, he's with you before the meeting and with you in the meeting and with you after the meeting. He's with you before the surgery, with you in the surgery, with you after the surgery, with you before the courtroom, with you in the courtroom, with you after the courtroom. You don't know when to shout. That means whatever is on my mind, he's already there, already taking care of it. And when I get there, he'll welcome me there. When I get there, he'll settle me there. When I get there, he'll take care of me there. And he will bring me out. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Slap five with your neighbor one more time and say, neighbor, let him prove himself. Let him show himself. Let him glorify himself. Let him magnify himself. Let him exalt himself. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Lift up your heads, all ye gates, and be lifted up, the everlasting doors, and the King of Glory shall come in. Who is the King of Glory? The Lord, strong and mighty. The Lord, mighty in battle. The Lord, almighty, all wise, all powerful. The Lord, excellent, greater, omnipotent. The Lord, merciful, gracious, healing, deliverer. The Lord, my defense, my refuge, my waymaker, my tear dryer. The Lord, my company keeper, my battle axe, my shelter. The Lord, the Lord, the Lord.